Where's that mate of yours?
Uftak asked.
The one what's been through these things before. Snaggy.
Nisquick's face fell.
Snaggy?
You looking to make me repeat myself?
Uftak asked, hefting the snazhammer meaningfully.
Cause that flippy spiky git what Shangtos gits mob ran away before I could give it a good pasting. So there's a pasting going spare, if you get me drift.
That had been infuriating. Uftak was quite impressed with how the spiky war boss, if that was what it was, had sliced its way through an entire mob of beast snaggers in a matter of seconds. However, it hadn't wanted any part of him once he'd tried to close with it, almost as though it was scared of getting it. Typical spikies. Only wanted to fight when they thought they could win. Their gods were probably wimps.
No, boss,
Nisquick said hurriedly, waving its hands.
No need for that. Just a bit confused, cos Snaggy said he was doing a secret thing for you, and that's why he ain't here.
Uftak wrinkled his brow.
Secret thing? Why does Soggy Neck would I get a grot to do a secret thing? There ain't nothing secret going on.
You mean?
Nisquick said, its expression sliding into delighted malevolence with the inexorable slowness of hot squid grease flowing across a tilted cooking pan.
That he was lying?
Zogged if I care,
Uftak huffed.
So you're saying you don't know where Snaggy is?
No, boss,
Nisquick said eagerly, then bit its own knuckles as it realised what it had just admitted to. Uftak booted him. The little grot went sailing through the air and collided with a death dread, then fell to the ground with a muffled,
sorry, boss.
Sogging grots,
Uftak muttered, spinning the snazhammer absent-mindedly. Well, there was nothing for it. He wasn't going to go looking for Snaggy or send anyone else to do it. It was utterly beneath him. The grot should be here, just in case it was needed. Now Uftak just had to remember to give it a clobbering next time he saw it to teach it a lesson, or for something to do. Well, if he didn't have the grot around to prod for more information on exactly how these things worked, they'd simply have to do the best they could. Probably just as well. What were the odds of a grot actually knowing anything useful? Besides, even if Snaggy were here and Uftak could find a spiky, the chances of the git making the portal do what he wanted were slim.
What this needs, Uftak said firmly, is some good old-fashioned orky know-whats.
He looked around.
Boffin! He's not here, boss,
someone piped up. It was one of the mech boys' spanners, a singed-looking bad moon with a skull that was rather more pointy than most, and the expression of an orc who had come to accept that the world in which he was so interested was always going to explode at him, and not in a fun way. Nazlug, Uftak remembered, that was his name.
Mog's teeth,
Uftak grumbled. Was no one where he wanted them to be.
Well, where is he? Went to get some more tools to repair the teleporter, boss,
the other orc said somewhat sheepishly, gesturing at the ruined structure next to him, then edging surreptitiously away from Princess, which was sniffing him with interest. Uftak raised his eyebrows.
He's got tools what can repair that.
Nazlug gave the shrug of an orc who felt unqualified to comment on the exact nature of his mech boy's abilities, and Uftak sighed. He could already feel the momentum of the war stalling. They'd found and killed most of the spikies in this bit of their home, but he was sure there was a lot more of it somewhere. The raiding force that had come through and blown the teleport pad up had to have come from somewhere, after all. However, knowing it was there was no use if he couldn't get to it, and although his lads had just had an invigorating scrap against the spikies, the gits had disappeared once it became obvious they weren't doing very well. The trouble was, orcs didn't just stop fighting because the enemy had disappeared. If you'd stomped them all, then that was one thing. Then you could have a fungus beer, laugh about the best bits with the lads, and call it a job well done. Sure, you'd need to find some more gits before long, but that was what the war was for, wasn't it? See the galaxy and kill anything you found that fancied a scrap. That was the orcish way. When the enemy disappeared halfway through a fight, though, that was a different matter entirely. That wasn't satisfying. Your blood was up. You wanted something to hit, or something to hit you even, and there was nothing around that fit the bill. Except, of course, other orcs. And there was nothing wrong with orcs fighting other orcs. Of course there wasn't. It was the way of things. Across the galaxy, orcs fought with other orcs more often than they fought anyone or anything else. Mainly because another orc was always willing to have a scrap and there was usually one within arm's reach. Gawk and Mork wouldn't have it any other way. But the truth was that Uftak felt it was simply a waste for the lads to start fighting each other now. The point of a war was that it was orcs under one boss, all gunning for the same enemy, whoever that might be. That was why a war boss was a war boss. He was the boss all other bosses followed, rather than just being one of many all fighting each other. If the tech war started scrapping amongst itself now, with the spikies so close at hand, okay, so Uftak didn't know exactly where they were, other than on the other side of the gate, but they were definitely close in a theoretical sense, well, then it would be a disaster. It would be proof that Uftak wasn't ready to be a big boss. And while he wasn't that bothered whether or not he lived up to the Mech Lord's assessment of him, Uftak himself very much liked being big boss. They needed some more spikies to stomp and sharpish, or things were going to get fractious. In fact, things already were. Away past a blazing stomper that had been set on fire by a lucky shot to the fuel tanks, a big mob of Bad Moon shooter boys were squaring up to a dozen Death Skull tank busters, who were outnumbered but considerably more heavily armed. Mork only knew how the spat had started. It could have been anything from who got a choice bit of loot to someone treading on someone else's toe, but it was about to spill over from strong words into violence if the gathering crowd of grinning onlookers and the grots hastily taking bets were anything to go by. Part of Uftak wanted to just let it happen and have a good old laugh while bits of orc flew everywhere. However, that wasn't going to help him find and stomp the spikies who needed stomping. So he shouldered the snazhammer, whistled for Princess, which came trotting after him, hoping for treats like a severed limb, and strode towards his lads to get them to think again. Or just think once, even. That might be enough. Uftak was passing through the shadows beneath the stomper when he recognised the orc at the head of the shooter boys. Defro, formerly one of Uftak's own mob, who had gone and got himself a mob of his own now his former knob was the big boss. He was sneering and waving the power claw he'd fitted to replace the hand that got mangled when he hit a Humi mech boy with a stick bomb, and it looked like the tankbuster's knob wasn't too impressed with the gestures Defro was making, judging by the way he was fingering the butts of his rocket pistols. Uftak drew in a breath to begin a bellow that would put both of them in their place, and the darkness attacked him. One moment, he was walking through the shadows, deeper patches of blackness in an already dim world cast by the fires above, and the next, something was clawing its way out of a patch of darkness at head height and reaching for him with a claw on which strange glyphs glowed with a cold fire. A Humi would have frozen in fear and shock and had its throat clawed out. It would take more than a suddenly sharp shadow to trouble Uftak Blackhawk, however, and he responded to the threat as soon as it revealed itself by whipping the snazhammer up and delivering a blow that snapped the limb in question and drew a squealing snarl of pain from whatever it belonged to. A dozen more suddenly sharp shadows, though. That might cause a problem, and that was what was coming for him now. They dropped from above, pulled themselves from the ground, and squeezed out from the shadowed metal pillars of the stomper's legs. They were bipedal, with hides of midnight hue, clad in ragged dark leathers and clutching curved blades that reflected only the faintest glimmers of light. Apart from that, they were in no way uniform. Some were covered in glyphs lit from within by cold fire like the army'd swatted, and some had skins that were unmarked. Some leered with mouths full of sharp fangs beneath blazing eyes, and the faces of others were featureless pools. All they had in common was their obvious murderous intent. Princess leaped at one with a bloodthirsty battle squeal, and everyone started fighting at once. One of the shadow gits thrust its hand at Uftak and pale fire billowed from it, as though it were a Death Killer War Trike's exhaust rocket. Uftak managed to jerk his head aside from the blast, which whipped past his left ear like a cloud of aggressive ice. Cold fire? This place just got weirder and weirder. But the slight shift in his momentum brought him directly into the path of one of those glimmering blades. The curved tip arced downwards into his chest, but stopped with a ping as it struck an armour plate. Weird or not, these gits' actual weapons seemed solid enough. Uftak lashed out with a punch that struck an inky black face with a satisfying crunch of breaking bones and splintering teeth, even though the mouth wasn't visible at the moment his fist made contact. The shadow git dropped like a pole-axed grot and fell straight through the shadows on the floor and out of sight. Uftak would have paused to gape at that, but he had no time to do so. The rest of the shadow git's mates were on him. They were scrawnies of some sort. He could tell by the infuriating way they moved, all flowing grace and supple evasion, with a speed of reaction that would have left even a beaky swinging clumsily at blurred afterimages, and a regular Humi crawling on the floor looking for its guts within a second. They had a savage edge, though, these Shadowgits, and they lent into their blows more. Scrawnies and spikies alike usually poked and probed, hesitant to commit to an actual fight unless they were sure they weren't going to get hurt back. These ones swung as though they held a grudge against the air between them and him, and were trying to carve straight through Uftak to get to something on the other side. It was quite bracing, really. He roared and swung the snazhammer, pulverising one of the shadow gits with a single blow, but another one blasted him with cold flame from his left, sending spikes of icy pain down his flank. He blocked a blade with the snazhammer's haft, only to find a second worming its way between armour plates, through his hide and between his ribs. He grabbed that git with his free hand and hurled it into one of its mates, but then something stabbed him in the back of his right leg, which buckled beneath him and brought him down to one knee. He punched backwards with the snazhammer, not even bothering to turn the weapon around, and the butt of its haft caught the culprit in whatever served as its throat. And still they fought. Uftak caught a glimpse of Princess dragging one away by its leg, the shadow git's utterly alien face still somehow conveying the startled expression of something which was far more used to being the one doing the unwanted dragging. But the others were pressing in on him in a welter of throaty snarls and glinting blades. He grabbed one by the throat, but the weapon of its neighbour hacked into his bicep. He tried to sweep them away with the snazhammer, but one of his enemies had grabbed onto the weapon's haft and weighted it down, then sank suddenly appearing teeth into the flesh of his hand. Uftak yelled in pain and outrage and let go of the snazhammer. The shadow git staggered back with it, barely able to take the weight of the massive weapon. Uftak drew a slugger from his belt, a faithful old weapon that had been with him since his time as a regular boy in Bad Git Snazhammer's mob, and pumped shots into the bellies of two of the shadow gits right in front of him. They also staggered backwards, but only due to the impact of the slugs, which had torn right through them and left wet holes behind. Uftak emptied the weapon into a third body, roared in fury as something sharp pierced his shoulder, dropped the slugger, and lashed out with an open-handed slap that not only mashed a shadow git right in the face, but had the added bonus of triggering his palm button. The shadow git that had stolen the snazhammer was trying to manoeuvre the hefty weapon around into a position to take a swing at Uftak when the weapon disappeared, taking the git's hands with it. The strange creature screamed, a high keening noise that set Uftak's teeth on edge, and the snazhammer reappeared square in Uftak's grasp, just like it was supposed to do every time. Well, so long as the Zoggin thing did it when it really counted. He energised the head and punched it forwards, obliterating the midsection of one of his attackers, then surged upright. The sharp pain in his leg was still there, but it was no longer a surprise, and he'd become accustomed to it. Besides, he had a whole bunch of different new pains now, courtesy of his assailants, so all in all it was more of a baseline, as it were. However, he'd been whittling the shadow git's numbers down, and none of the wounds they had dealt him were sufficient to stop him. He was Uftak Blackhawk. Uftak Gargant Smasher, and he hadn't been stopped when his head came off his body that time. He wasn't going to get dragged down like some weedy grot by this bunch of gits. He spun the snazhammer, and the butt of the haft cracked one shadow git under the chin, flooring it. He whirled around with the weapon's momentum and carved clean through another with the axe blade and lashed out with his left leg to kick a third so hard in the chest that it sailed clean out from under the stomper and into what passed for daylight beyond. Princess sprang and bore the handless one to the ground, the squig's happily ravenous squeals hitting nearly the same pitch as the ragged, tearing screams of the luckless alien being torn apart by its fangs. And that left two. One leaped at him, reaching out to engulf him in ice fire again, but Uftak was too quick this time. He grabbed the thing's arm and directed the blast up and away from him, then leaned forward and simply bit the shadow git's head off. His jaws enveloped its skull without difficulty, and his teeth crunched a slender spine and crushed and sheared their way through the narrow column of flesh. He chewed once. It tasted cold and dark, like licking the space between stars, and spat the mangled mouthful out. The last shadow git, the one he'd cracked on the chin and knocked down, didn't wait to meet its end. It dived for the blackest patch of shadow left and vanished, just before Princess pounced. The squig hit the stomper's leg face first and rebounded with a confused whine. Uftak looked out into the light, just in time to see the shadow git he'd kicked out there get engulfed in flame, explosions and shooter fire. Death Row's mob and the tank busters they'd been arguing with had taken their sweet time to notice that their boss was being attacked by weird alien things, but they were at least emphatic in dealing with it once they had.
"You good, boss?"
Death Row called once the smoke had cleared and a few dark, wet gobbets were all that was visible of the last attacker.
"Nah," Uftak said. "Nah?"
Death Row looked sideways at the tank buster knob, then sidled a little closer.
"Did the gits get you?"
It wasn't concern on Death Row's face. Orcs were rarely concerned by their own injuries, let alone those of others. It was simple interest, because if Uftak had been badly hurt and was about to keel over, then the entire leadership of this part of the Tekwar might be up for grabs, and Death Row would want a running start at it.
"That ain't it,"
Uftak said, striding out from beneath the stomper. He threw the snazhammer up into the air and caught it again with a meaty thwack, but he wasn't really interested in showing off right now. He was furious.
"Sending shadows at me," he bellowed, causing every single orc looking at him to take a step back in alarm. "Sogging shadows. Not coming to face me one-on-one like a proper warrior. Not coming at us with guns and blades and those sippy flying what's-its. This ain't a fight. This is a sogging insult. I ain't standing for it. Zog the Mechlord and Zog the Tekwar. These gits have made it personal, and I'm gonna wring their scrawny little necks for it."
He stopped, panting slightly with how hard he'd been screaming. His boys were staring at him uncertainly now, clearly wondering exactly what was going to happen next and how many of them were likely to end up as squig food as a result. Orcs didn't often lose their temper because most things that might cause them to do so were just an excuse to have a fight, which was a good thing, and so nothing to get angry about. When a large orc actually flipped, things got unpredictable. Uftak could actually feel himself vibrating, he was so angry. The zogging cheek of it. To send their shadowy little commandos, or whatever the spiky equivalent was, to try to take him out. And the worst thing was, there was very little he could do about it. He could smash this place up fine, oh yes, he could blast it and bomb it and wallop it with the snazhammer until every remaining spiky skulking somewhere in the ruins was a fine paste, and the buildings themselves were just monochrome dust, but that wouldn't help him get at the ones that had caused this. He whirled around and stared at the portal, the thing separating him from his enemies, yet also the only way to them. The infuriatingly alien, incomprehensible. Wait. Absolute fury was surging through him in the aftermath of the fight. Not just the usual exhilaration and aggression that was a part of such activity, but a burning anger, unlike anything he'd felt before. And it was unlocking things as it went. The sheer desire to get at his enemies, to get his hands on them and make them pay for their arrogance and hubris, made him think about things in ways he never had.
"Someone get me the boffin," he bellowed. "And also one of his spanners, what no one likes, and a shock attack gun, and a weird boy what ain't exploded anyone's head recently. I am getting through that git." "Now, I ain't usually the one asking this," the boffin said, "but are you sure this is going to work?" "Yes,"
Uftak replied, and to his astonishment, he was. The trick was holding onto his anger enough to retain his concentration without letting it take hold of him so much that he clobbered his best mech boy.
"Simple, innit? Shock attack guns make a sort of weird tunnel, right? Just like shock jump dragsters do, like what me and Mogrot used to get through that Humi Gargant shields that time. Only the gun makes a tunnel you shoot snotlings down."
"Gotcha,"
the boffin said, nodding.
"So if we link the gun up to the portal," Uftak said, nodding towards the cables that had been shoved into the scrawny's archway in places the boffin had felt were most suitable, "we can make our own tunnel to the other side."
"Well, I ain't saying that's a bad idea,"
the boffin said,
"particularly since it ain't going to be me holding the gun."
They both glanced over at Nazlug, who looked about as dejected as it was possible to be if you were an orc with a massive gun bolted to his shoulder plate.
"In case it all goes a bit weird, we don't want you letting go of it accidentally, do we?"
Then their collective gazes travelled down the other cable now attached to the shock attack gun, which terminated in a metal spike driven into the skull of a weird boy known as Uzkop.
"That part, though,"
the boffin said thoughtfully,
"that's what's stumping me."
Uzkop himself was whimpering, although that possibly had less to do with the spike in his head and more to do with the natural state of a weird boy when surrounded by other orcs. Even Uftak could feel the energy of the lads he gathered together. Aggression and frustration in equal measure, just the sort of thing that could charge up a weird boy's brain and bring forth his devastating powers. If you were lucky, you could aim to get at the enemy and have him melt their faces off. If you were unlucky, on the other hand, he'd explode a bunch of your boy's heads, possibly including yours and quite possibly including his own. Uzkop was clinging desperately to his copper staff, which helped earth the power, while his two burly minders hovered nearby in case they were needed.
"Making the tunnel's just the first part,"
Uftak said.
"We still gotta make the tunnel go where we want it to. And since the git with the gun can't see what he's shooting at, we need something else to do the targeting. That's what the weird boy's for."
It all seemed so simple, somehow, as though the knowledge had always been there within him, just waiting to be discovered. The spikies had given him a problem, and he'd come up with a solution. This was when all the thinking finally paid off. He turned around. The war, or a large part of it anyway, those the knobs had been able to round up, were assembled in as close to good order as orcs were ever likely to manage. There wasn't a great deal of jostling or shoving. The speed freaks were managing to keep their engine revving under control. The beast snaggers were preventing their squigogs and smasher squigs from rampaging off and eating anyone. Even the stompers weren't sounding their war horns. Every one of them seemed to sense that something big was about to go down, and they were willing to hold their natural exuberance in check for the moment, just to see what was going on and whether they could get a good fight out of it. Uftak reached out his hand. Nizquick shoved the shouty cone into it, and Uftak raised it to his mouth.
"All right, listen up."
His enhanced voice bellowed with a crackle and squeal of feedback, focusing every orc's attention on him.
"The spikies thought they could hit us and leg it, but we ain't gonna stand for it, are we? No!
The Tekwar thundered as one, raising various weapons into the air and shaking them vigorously.
So what we're gonna do is, we're gonna go through this thing and give 'em a good old kicking.
Uftak continued, to roars of approval.
We're gonna find 'em, and we're gonna stomp 'em into the dirt. Ain't that right? Yes!
The Tekwar hollered joyfully. Uftak grinned, turned around, and pointed at Nazlug.
Fire it up.
The spanner obediently clenched the shooty lever, and the three-pronged shocker on the front of the huge gun began to spin. The charged orbs at the end of each arm sparked with energy, dragging blazing trails through the air as they moved faster and faster, until Nazlug was half obscured behind a whirring circle of blue lightning. The first telltale signs of interdimensional disturbance began to flicker in front of him, the beginnings of the shocker portal that could move things from one place to another without bothering about the space between.
Now!
Uftak shouted, and De Boffin threw his switch. The power that was starting to build up in the shock attack gun was abruptly rerouted, flowing into the scrawny's portal, and the air within the archway, which had been empty and unremarkable, crackled and came to life. It became opaque, shimmering with a cold light, like an aurora reflected on the waves of an Arctic sea.
Staff!
Uftak bellowed, and Uskop's minders ripped the staff from his grasp. The weird boy's eyes went wide, then were eclipsed by a bright green glow from within. He began to twitch uncontrollably, and the minders grabbed him to keep him in place. All that war energy, flowing into Uskop from the assembled orcs, began to build up. Every part of it was focused on one thing: finding the spikies that had attacked them, and making them pay for it. No matter where they were, no matter where they'd hidden, the thing at the forefront of every orc's mind was getting to them. Uftak had made sure they were concentrating on it. Energy crackled out of the spike in Uskop's head and skittered along the cable that linked him to the shock attack gun, and the gun's whirring took on a new tone, like the distant rumble of thousands of angry voices. The portal flickered, wavered, then stabilised again with a slightly different pattern of shifting light within it. It had worked. Uftak knew it had, although he couldn't verbalise how. However, he didn't need to. He clapped De Boffin on the shoulder, ran to his truck and vaulted up into the back. Nisquick scrabbled on after him, and Princess bounded up behind.
Mogrod!
He roared, as his sidekick threw the truck into gear.
Step on it.
The vehicle lurched forward, and behind him, Uftak heard the almighty roar of his lads, united again in a single purpose, surging after him with their war cry on their lips.
Here we go! 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 Here we go!
Chapter 14. The throne room of the Cabal of the Hollow Heart was the centre of Dimera's power. It was the grandest hall in her entire spire, a massive space that occupied the entire width of Heartpoint, albeit the narrower portion near the apex of it. Above it were her decoy chambers, too easily accessible from the outside to be considered safe in a city in which gravity was a mere annoyance to most and inconsequential to many, and the roof on which she had met Zothar Orydreed and sent him to his death. Beneath her were her real chambers, buried in the midst of the tower, but equipped with sympathy windows, so she could look out over her domain from the structure's actual exterior without presenting herself as a target for assassinations. Below that were the torture chambers and dungeons, and farther down still were the barracks, mess halls, training rooms and armories for her warriors, who stood ready to repel any assault coming in from ground level. Which was not, of course, to say that there were not other guard stations throughout the spire, since Dimera's ancestors had not been so foolish as to leave no protection between themselves and the wretched creatures they captured and tormented. Dimera herself had her own private staircases and anti-grav shafts by which she traversed her home, each one coded solely to her palm print, eye scan, blood chemistry or breath, and with the method of security used to access each, switching on a pattern that only she knew. The tower had several virtually impregnable chambers in which Dimera could take shelter in the case of an emergency, as well as a variety of exits, many of which were known only to her, and all of which had a variety of lethal countermeasures to ensure no one came up them the wrong way. With all of these thoroughly prudent precautions against attack in mind, it might have seemed strange that Dimera sat openly on her throne in the middle of a huge space in which there were a multitude of shadows and places to hide. The throne room was, after all, filled with statues of her forebears, mighty edifices honouring the Dark Muses, and grand depictions of the general superiority of the Drukhari over all other species of the galaxy, leaving plenty of places in which assassins could conceal themselves. Dimera let herself be seen within it for two reasons. Firstly, while paranoia was prudent, being seen to be paranoid was not. Dimera's authority as Master Archon rested on others perceiving her as strong, and an Archon who cowered behind closed doors and bodyguards practically invited open plotting against themselves. Her presence and visibility was just another trap, designed to encourage the overconfident to spring their schemes only to see them shatter against her defences like cheap blades on good armour. Secondly, there were plenty of assassins hiding in the shadows and alcoves of the throne room because Dimera had stationed them there herself. However, perhaps the most dangerous, or at the least most unnerving of them all, was currently on one knee on the floor in front of the steps that descended from Dimera's throne. His skin drank in light rather than reflected it, apart from the cold glow emanating from the sigils of destruction etched into his flesh. His fingers ended in savage talons, and the darkness of his face did not hide the glint of his fangs. Dimera leaned forwards in her seat. Define failed. Kerazul of Ailindrak did not raise his head to look at her. Curtains of lank, colourless hair fell on either side and in front of his face, obscuring much of it from view. It was a strange sight to see a mandrake so cowed. Dimera would have enjoyed the novelty of the experience, had the reason for it not been so infuriating.
The Arrakia was too strong and too ferocious,
Kerazul intoned, in a voice that sounded like claws scraping across lead. Although Dimera could not be sure, she did not think that the creature's mouth moved when it spoke.
We wounded it, but could not kill it. Only I escaped, in order to bring you word of its continued existence.
Did you not set on it when it was alone? Dimera asked. But that was the point of Mandrake, surely, to attack enemies when they thought they were safe. Or were orcs just so gregarious that it was impossible to get one by itself?
It was alone, Kerazul replied, save for its pet.
Now he raised his head and fixed his cold eyes on her.
This Arrakia is a fell creature, not just brutal but swift and cunning. It slew my kin without needing any aid from its own.
Dimera ground her teeth in irritation. The mandrakes had been Maculatix's idea, although the slaves to pay them had come from Dimera's dungeons. It should have been enough. The fact that the orc chieftain had not only survived the attack, but also butchered its assailants by itself, spoke strongly of just what a formidable creature it was. On the other hand, if an entire pack of mandrakes could not bring the orc down with a surprise attack, Dimera's own inability to land a blow on it did not seem quite so humiliating. Maculatix had not openly laughed at her in the wake of their retreat from Sabergate, but Dimera could tell that he wanted to. Seeing his expression when he heard how abysmally his plan had failed would be the very small, faint silver lining of this thoroughly unwelcome cloud. And your payment? She asked, biting off her words slowly and deliberately.
Will be returned,
Kerizal replied, tonelessly. The fees mandrakes demanded for their services from the Drukhari nobility who hired them could vary wildly, but the investment was almost always a secure one. Dimera was now glad that Kerizal had only asked for captives to take back to the shadow realm of Ailindrak, rather than something more esoteric. At the very least, they were easier to demand be returned than one's own true name, or a heartbeat, or any other such strange request. See that it is, Dimera said. She wasn't quite sure what she would do if it was not. She hardly wished to launch an assault on Ailindrak in search of retribution, even if the orcs weren't a more pressing concern. But there were appearances to be maintained. Besides, killing Kerizal for his failure would guarantee that she would not see her investment back, so this promise was probably a cunning move on the mandrake's part. You may leave, she said. And the mandrake rose to his feet. He did not head for the door, simply for the nearest patch of true shadow into which he vanished without trace. It was an uncomfortable reminder of how deadly he and his kind were. Except to this orc chieftain, apparently. She stood and held out her arms. Servants rushed forward with her cloak and fastened it about her shoulders quickly and efficiently, then backed away with their faces lowered as she began to descend the steps to the throne room floor. Everyone could tell that the Master Archon was in a foul mood, and no one wished to be on the wrong side of her temper. No one apart from family. Dear sister, Dalgar said, emerging from behind a massive plinth carved into the shape of bodies contorted in pain. How it grieves me to see your failure laid bare. Dalgar Thrakes, when not a pile of bloody meat in the aftermath of having a vehicle land on him, was tall enough to look Dimera in the eyes, not to mention confident enough. He was currently arrayed in his second favourite armour, his actual favourite not having survived his first encounter with the orcs, and was resting the wrist of his left hand lightly on the pommel of his sheathed blade. Dimera did not trust that sword at all. She did not know from where Dalgar had got it, and even in a city of cursed weapons and foul creations, it had an unpleasant, twisted aura all of its own.
You will note that I am still hale and whole, Dimera pointed out, rather than just returned from the Red Harvest's ministrations. You may wish to consider that when you next open your mouth.
Dalgar smirked.
Why? Because I was the victim of an accident caused by my pilot's poor decision-making, whereas you ran from a fight. Because I might just send you back there,
Dimera snapped, taking a step to stand toe-to-toe with him. Dalgar did not flinch or step backwards, but his lips pursed thoughtfully, and his next words were, if not respectful, at least delivered in a neutral tone rather than a barely disguised sneer.
The mandrakes were your idea. Maculatix's, Dimera replied.
And now?
Now I speak to my allies and we consider our next move, Dimera said. The immediate threat of the Arrakis teleporting was ended. Now we need to prepare a more concerted attack to wipe them out once and for all. There are still alliances to forge, primarily with the witch cults.
She eyed him.
Are you capable of resuming command of your shard?
Of course, Dalgar said with a snort.
The Shard of the Cruelest Light was the largest faction within the Cabal, apart from Dimera's own court, as befitted the Master Archon's only living blood relative. The other three shards, the Void Ascendant, the False Hope, and the Eyeless Gaze, had their own Archons, each of whom Dimera actually trusted more than she did her brother, although that statement still stretched the definition of trust to breaking point. However, Dalgar was a fearsome warrior and a talented strategist when he wasn't trying to show off, and so he was, for now at least, worth keeping around.
Then do so,
Dimera instructed him. She pushed past him, forcing him to step aside.
Come, I have a war to plan. You have made an alliance with the Falling Knight, Dalgar hissed into her ear as their raider pulled alongside the dark green Tantalus that bore Sistriel Vern and his bodyguard. The other Cabals have acknowledged my authority and looked to me for direction, Dimera replied quietly. Vern and Maculitic stand with us. Port Tavar is as close to United as it has been since Farrell died. What about this arrangement do you find disagreeable, brother? Vern cannot be trusted, Dalgar said firmly, looking straight ahead as though refusing to sully his eyes with a glance at the Archon in question. You are a fool if you do so. Who says I trust him? Dimera replied with a snort. His interests and ours align for now, and he is intelligent enough to realize that. All the same, her mind went back to that moment when she had been plucked out of peril by Sistriel Vern, and those moments she spent dangling above the roaring mass of the Orc Horde before being hauled aboard the Tantalus that now ran alongside them. Would Dalgar have come to her rescue? If he had, would he have let her fall into a roiling mass of alien savages, blame a faulty grip, and then seek to take command of her cabal? Dimera was fairly sure she knew the answer to that question. Ambition drove Dalgar just as surely as it drove her, but her brother lacked patience and long-term thinking. If he gained command, then the cabal would undoubtedly fall to ruin. Not immediately, perhaps, but certainly after a few decades. More importantly, if he gained command, then it would be because Dimera was dead, which was a far greater incentive to keep Dalgar in his place. Do you at least approve of our choice of allies within the witch cults? She asked, as their small group of craft banked around a ruined spur of what had once been a building, but which now resembled nothing more than an angular headland of pitted dark stone. Indistinct, shuffling shapes fluttered uneasily as the flyers passed close by, a colony of gloom wings roosting in the shadows and waiting for the diseased light of the captured sun to wane a little before embarking on a hunt through Port Tavar's streets and skies. An outsider might question why the Drukhari still needed enclosed homes, since there was no weather to speak of in Camorra, but only if they had not seen the predators that stalked the dark city's shadowed streets. The cult of the Deathly Sorrow, Dalgar nodded. Numerous, fierce, and unlike the Silver Shards, not hungry for your blood. There are certainly worse choices that you could have made. His tone made it sound as if it were sheer luck that had guided her to this choice, rather than a careful analysis of fighting strength and allegiances. Dimera snorted again and forced herself not to rise to her brother's baiting. Still, her position as Master Archon could survive no more mistakes. The Orcs had demonstrated themselves to be unpredictable enemies who appeared able to frustrate even the best-laid plans. Even more infuriating was the fact that this seemed to happen through sheer chance or blind luck on the creature's part, as though the universe bent itself to accommodate whatever was most convenient for them with little regard for the rules that governed the lives of other species. Being outwitted by an adversarial mastermind such as a scheming fellow Drukhari, or an Azuriani Farseer capable of surveying the skeins of fate and guiding their milk-blooded followers down the most beneficial paths, or even the demonic intelligence of one of the servant beasts of chaos. These were outcomes for which the wise Archon prepared themselves. The crude hammer of the Orcish war machine and their bestial resilience and savage ferocity were dangerous. But being outflanked by them, being forced to react to unexpected stratagems and their bizarre technologies, it was humiliating. Her flotilla passed through a massive arch that was carved into the shape of two demonic-looking entities bound together and facing away from each other, their horns interlocked and their clawed arms twisted back to be wrapped around the other's neck, and their expressions contorted into ones of horrified pain. Perhaps it had been intended as a monument to Camorra's triumph even over the denizens of the warp, or perhaps the artist had simply had a particularly active imagination. Either way, it was an isolated structure now, damaged and corroded by time, and surrounded by the dead and broken shells of abandoned buildings in which nothing lived save for the most desperate of Camorra's residents and the beasts that hunted them.
Up ahead, however, was something far more vibrant. The arena of the cult of the Deathly Sorrow was the size of a city of a lesser species. A gigantic circular amphitheatre sunken partially into the ground, the walls of which were set with hundreds of thousands of seats, varying from narrow, uncomfortable perches for the poor to luxurious private boxes for the wealthy and influential that were practically second homes. A sizable chunk of Port Tavar's population could and did come here on a regular basis to watch Hecatari of the cult engaging in gladiatorial combat, either with each other, with captured beasts, or with alien fighters, and skyboard and jet bike riders racing through specially constructed courses, with each new turn providing the potential for a gruesome high-speed death. And that was leaving aside the fact that the rival contestants would be trying to kill each other even as they raced. This was just one of several such arenas within Port Tavar, and Port Tavar was merely one of the innumerable sub-realms that made up Camorra, greatest of all cities, and surely the largest contiguous inhabited area within the galaxy, if indeed it was within the galaxy at all, thanks to the strange nature of the webway. Regardless, it gave Dimera a certain chill to look at the arena of Deathly Sorrow and consider not just how mighty the forces were that dwelled within it, but how even that strength paled in comparison to the Drukhari race in total. Truly, her kind were still the unquestioned rulers of the galaxy, no matter how many pathetic planets the Orcs or the Monkey laid claim to. She had often come here to sample the delights of the gory, pain-racked spectacles it offered. Because while there was a delicious intimacy and far greater individual gain to be had from torturing a victim yourself, the sheer unpredictability of the games offered its own thrilling reward. The sudden reversal of fortunes on the arena floor that saw a bleeding warrior cut down their now overconfident opponent, or a proud reaver losing control of their jet bike or careering into an unseen razor net and briefly becoming an agonised smear on the wall. These moments imbued the spectator with a rush that could never be achieved when one was in full control of events. Sometimes it was not so much about the quantity or even quality of the soul nourishment extracted from another being's suffering, but the overall experience of it. Now, however, they were not approaching for the purposes of leisure. Their craft descended towards the wide roof, which had space for hundreds of raiders, but were greeted by the rising shapes of skyboards and reavers coming up to meet them. It was not just Drukhari either. Dimera saw the dark shapes of razor wings keeping pace with a couple of the skyboards, the massive carnivorous avians flanking the beastmasters that had broken them in.
"It appears that Zazuli is not welcoming visitors at present,"
Mikulatik shouted across from his radar. The master Hemunculus's tone was light, but Dimera could sense the tension that lay beneath. Were they too late? Had some hitherto unconsidered rival made an approach to the cult of the Deathly Sorrow, seeking to usurp power within Port Tavar? She loosened her blast pistol in its holster.
"What business do you have here?" the lead reaver demanded.
His blank-featured mask contained a voice amplifier, which sent his words booming and crackling around them.
"The next games are not until dark time."
"We come to speak with Succubus Zuzuli Mindrex," Dimera called back. "I sent a scourge ahead."
The reaver laughed.
"Your little bird must have fallen prey to something on its way here. My mistress has not mentioned that she is expecting guests."
"Then you can tell her that some have arrived," Sister Ulverne said.
He was standing at the very prow of his Tantalus, his hair whipped by the winds that trawled through Camorra despite the apparent lack of atmospheric processes to create them.
"Master Archon, Sister Ulverne of the Cabal of the Falling Night, and Dimera Thriggs of the Cabal of the Hollow Heart, and Master Hemunculus Mikulatix of the Coven of the Red Harvest, as well as our underlings," he added, with a sideways glance that was not directly aimed at Dalgar, but was also not directly not aimed at him.
Dimera felt her lips quirk in a smirk as her brother let out a hiss of anger.
"Yes, yes," the reaver said.
I know your colours and can read your iconography.
Then perhaps you should see whether your mistress wishes to reconsider her position, Dimera called to him. We are on a matter of some urgency, and we would rather seek what we need elsewhere than bandy words with a gatekeeper. She was too far away to read what could be seen of the Reaver's expression, but the way he pulled his jet bike back and down made it clear enough that he was passing on their words. For her part, Dimera was thinking furiously. What had happened to her messenger? Scourges were practically untouchable in Camorra, since the sensitive messages they carried were too important to the functioning of society for it to be any other way. A natural fate was not out of the question. There were plenty of aerial predators in the Dark City after all, some of them large and savage enough to trouble even one of the Drukhari who had mastered the skies on their own grafted wings. But it was unlikely. Could a particularly desperate enemy have attempted to sabotage this meeting? Her eyes slid sideways to Dalgar of their own accord, but Dimera got her paranoia back under control with some effort. Dalgar wished for the orcs to be destroyed just as much as she did, more so, perhaps, since he must yearn to atone for his indignity, and an alliance with the cult of the Deathly Sorrow was a great step towards achieving that. It would not serve his purposes to undermine her. Not yet, at any rate.
Well, well, Vern said, just loud enough for Dimera to hear him. It looks as though our host may have discovered her manners after all.
A venom was rising up from the arena's rooftop, and in the passenger compartment, Dimera could see the distinctive shock of night-black hair that marked Zuli Mindrex out from a distance. Her mane was nearly as long as she was tall, and only a high clasp atop her head kept it bound up and under some form of control. She was surrounded by five other warriors, five of her blood brides, the finest witches under her command. Not all of them are female, of course, since blood bride was a title rather than a description. Indeed, Zazuli herself had only taken on a female form in the last few decades since ascending to the rank of succubus, in the same way as every Azuriani warrior who explored the warrior aspect of the Howling Banshees was female, and most incubi were male. Some roles within Eldari society overrode the tenuous grip of biology. It was one of the few constants across all the varied strands of the species' existence.
Grand succubus,
Dimera greeted her as the venom rose into hailing range. I understand that my message did not arrive.
No, I received it, Zazuli replied.
Her voice and posture were lazy, but it was the laziness of a reclining predator which was nevertheless ready to pounce should prey present itself. Succubi were the pinnacle of death-dealing within the Drukhari, and Zazuli was one of the best among them. Dimera was a fine warrior, but she had few illusions about who would win in single combat between her and Zazuli Mindrex. That was one reason why it was so important to recruit the succubus to their cause. The witch cults lacked the massed firepower of the cabals, or the sheer resilience and immunity to pain of the homunculus covens, but they were unmatched for quicksilver lethality.
I found it somewhat amusing, Zazuli continued, fixing each of them with a stare one after another.
Her eyes had been altered or replaced, and no longer had any whites, merely dark pools.
These Arrakia must be formidable indeed for you to come begging my aid.
Dimera bristled, as she could feel the others doing as well. To accuse another Drukhari of begging was a calculated insult. Vern opened his mouth. To list, Dimera was certain, the identified assets of the Orc force in order to drive home exactly how serious a threat they were. Vern had that kind of mind, neat and ordered. Dimera found her fellow Archon's mastery of details quite impressive. Not that she would ever admit that out loud, but something told her that it was not what was required here.
Their leader slew an entire pack of mandrakes by itself, she said, before Vern could frame his first syllable.
Zazuli straightened. The predator had detected a rustling in the long grass.
By itself.
So I was informed by the lone survivor, Dimera confirmed. She let that statement hang in the air for a moment, accompanied by its unspoken connotations. A mandrake, one of the terrors of the shadows, admitting how it and its kin had been bested by a single alien warlord.
Intriguing, Zazuli said. This sounds like a creature whom it might be most invigorating to face in combat.
Dimera shot a look at Vern, who gave the briefest of nods in return. Jumping in when your ally was about to speak might put fractures in an alliance, but the Archon of the Falling Knight could recognise when another had seen a quicker route to victory.
Very well, my friends,
Zazuli said. And now she no longer lounged against the rail of her craft, but was upright and alert, every muscle of her lean body prepared to spring.
The cult of the Deathly Sorrow will assist you in bringing death and suffering to these invaders. I have but one price.
Dimera schooled her expression. And that is?
The chieftain must be taken alive,
Zazuli purred.
I will have it in the arena, and will make great sport of it there.
Dimera gritted her teeth. That would be unwise.
You think to tell me what I can achieve in my own arena?
Zazuli snapped.
Not at all, Maculitix cut in. But plucking the cursed thing away from its followers and getting it here may well prove impossible. We know the Arrakia, and we know how they work. If their leader is slain, their internal coherence will fall apart, and they will tear themselves to shreds as the remaining lieutenants fight to establish dominance.
Out of the corner of her eye, Dimera saw Sistrul Vern shooting another glance at her. She ignored her fellow Archon and former rival for primacy after the death of Lord Farrell, and kept her attention on Zazuli instead.
A swift strike to annihilate this monster and its coterie. A swift strike of the sort the witch cults excel at is our surest strategy,
Maculitix continued.
That is why we have approached you.
I agree with everything you have said,
Zazuli replied.
However, my price remains the same.
Dimera closed her eyes in frustration for a moment.
Think about it, my friends,
Zazuli said, slipping back into her lazy tones.
Removing the Arrakia from its followers is functionally the same as killing it, is it not? It will still leave them leaderless and prone to fighting amongst themselves. Once that occurs, we can pick them off at our leisure.
Her expression hardened.
You let me worry about how I will achieve this, but if that creature is damaged in any way by any of your warriors, this alliance is concluded. Do we have an accord?
Dimera looked at Vern, and then at Maculitix, but there was little she could do. They needed a witch cult. And a powerful one at that, but also one that was not going to react to seeing them by drawing its blades and going for their throat. The cult of the Deathly Sorrow was the only one within Port Tavar to fit that bill.
Very well, she said.
The warlord is yours, but it must be neutralized.
Consider it done,
Zazuli said with a smile, which faltered as a noise reached their ears. It was far off and faint, but distinct nonetheless. Something had exploded, and as the noise came again and again, it became apparent that this was not going to be an isolated incident.
What is that?
Zazuli asked, her expression no longer so supercilious. It is the Arrakia, Dimera said. Somehow she knew what had happened without seeing it, even before carrier waves began to broadcast the latest development to the assembled nobility. They've breached the portal, she said, with grim certainty. They're in Port Tava. Chapter 15. When Snaggy woke up, he was already on his feet. Or, more accurately, he was being dragged along while upright, and his feet were acquiring friction burns from the ground.
What's it? What's going on?
He slurred, trying to force his legs into some semblance of movement.
The portal, boss,
said a voice from his left, and Snaggy looked around to see Gip there, supporting him with one shoulder under his arm.
It's opened, isn't it?
Said a voice from his other side, which proved to be Swipe. Snaggy looked ahead of him and blinked furiously to get his eyes to cooperate. One of the massive pale arches through which the spikies had swept on their ill-fated counterattack had activated again and was filled with the shimmering light that Snaggy remembered so well. However, rather than disgorging slender, bloodthirsty warriors attired in razor-edged armour, the portal was currently swallowing the massive, blocky and fume-belching shape of a stomper. The light closed behind the enormous walker's back, and a massive cheer went up from all around.
What the blazes are you doing?
Snaggy hissed, disentangling himself from his supporters.
We don't want to go through there. That's where all the orcs are going. We want to find the portal we came in through and leg it that way.
Yeah, well, don't think we got a choice in it, Gip muttered. Runt herds, innit?
Snaggy chanced to look over his shoulder and grimaced. His burgeoning mob of followers were trotting along at a fair clip, each one wearing the grim, slightly constipated expression of grots heading towards a fight, not because they wanted to, since the only fight a grot wanted to take part in was one where the enemy didn't know they were fighting, and also were facing the other way and had their backs exposed for a bit of enthusiastic stabbing, but because the possibility of what lay ahead was less alarming than the certainty of what followed behind. In this case, what followed behind was a pair of runt herds, surly orcs whose calling in the great chaotic melting pot of orcish society was to beat on grots, snotlings and squigs until they did what they were told. Each one had a fearsome-looking grot lash in one hand, while the other held the leash of a squighound, a ferocious beast more than capable of tracking down runaways and biting them in half.
Oh, sog it,
Snaggy muttered.
What happened to the spiky? After you lot left me to get clobbered by the disorderlies,
he added, nastily.
They carted it off, boss,
Nibs said from behind him.
Next thing we know, word's gone out that the big boss has got the portal open and we're all going through.